Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 1, Close to Practice Inquiry, Live Q&A.
Welcome back, everyone, to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, and we are live from the PGC Research Conference. I'd like to say that we've got an audience of thousands in front of us. We've got a very intimate but beautifully formed audience of PGC primary and secondary student teachers with us. And we've convened a panel of experts, no pressure, experts. And we're coming together today to talk about teachers' close to practice classroom inquiry. And we've asked our panelists to put together a presentation just to talk to you for a few minutes about their role with underneath that umbrella and how they feel that's going in their particular context. And then we're going to open it up to the audience if you've got any particular questions that you would like to ask on that theme and just get a bit of a dialogue going around that theme in general. So first of all, I should introduce our panel. And we've tried to pull together people from various different education contexts. So to my right, I've got Emma Aston from Whitchurch High School in Cardiff. I've got Sarah Kaysen from Palmerston Primary in the Vale of Glamorgan. Louise Mutton has joined us from Central South Consortium. And Dr. Matt Hutt is with us from the University of South Wales. So I think without further ado, although I should probably say that Tom is here as well.
I am here. I'm just very quiet.
He's there in the background. So Emma Aston, what's your take? Teachers close to practice classroom inquiry.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. So first of all, I think it's very important that we open our eyes to the fact that as a profession, I think we're probably one of the worst professions for closing off to research and inquiry once we start on that journey of being a teacher. Teaching is a very challenging role, obviously, but I think we're missing a trick, so to speak, if we don't use research and inquiry to really aid us to improve our practice and to push school improvement forward. So a little bit about me to begin with. I've been teaching a very long time, hence the wrinkles. I'm in my 27th year of teaching, all of which, this isn't necessarily a good thing, I don't know, all of which has been done in Whitchurch High School. I was there as a student teacher. I've been there as a teacher working part-time once I was having my own family, and have now since returned to full-time and have been seconded to senior leadership team for the past 2 years. And it's really in that position that I've had, I suppose, the best opportunity to drive research and inquiry as a vehicle for improvement within Whitchurch. What I've tried to do in order to achieve that is to align what I do with student teachers here in Cardiff Met and in the partnership with broader aspects of research and inquiry like the NPEP, which I'm sure Louise and Matt will talk a little bit further about. It's interesting that I think when you put on a various hats in education, you suddenly realise there are lots of things that help other parts of what you want to achieve. And I'm all about improving teaching and learning and making sure that we are the best practitioners that we can be. I think for me, the biggest sort of journey I've been on over the past 2 years with research and inquiry is enabling established teachers as well as teachers new to the profession to see that research and inquiry, it doesn't have to be a head in the book approach. It is far more proactive, I believe, as a close to practice action, so that you actually take on board something that you might find and think, oh, I think that could have legs in this school. This could be something that could have power here. But you have to be willing to be innovative, and you have to be willing to give things a try. And you also have to be willing to accept that sometimes they don't work. And that is as equally important, I think, to looking at things that do work. So aligning the things that I've done with the research champion role with Cardiff Met through the work that I've done with NPEP, so my own research guides what I then do as part of my leading role within school, so that hopefully that the alignment of all those things mean that we move on and we make good progress.
Thank you very much, Emma. Moving swiftly on to Sarah Kaysen, who's going to speak to the same theme.
Yes, thank you, Emma. Again, really thankful for coming today, because I think this is a really important aspect of where we are in education in Wales. And very similar to you, actually, my journey. I'm currently head at Palmerston Primary, but along that way, I've worn many hats. And I think when I was pondering this morning, thinking about, gosh, my link with research, when I first became a teacher many, many moons ago, I think you qualified and that was it, really. That culture of professional learning and that continuum of learning wasn't really a heavy feature of what you did. You did your BA or your PGCE and that was it. You were almost thrust into a classroom, sent on courses, possibly quite passively, and you went away, you had a nice lunch and so on, so on. So I think for me, having been, you know, going through this journey, it has been a cultural shift, and that shift towards that recognition and understanding that professional learning is very, very much part of what we do as teachers. And I think for me, at the grassroots, it's that real understanding of, you know, it's okay to be curious about things, to self-reflect. And I think, again, you know, with my hat as head teacher, creating the climate for that has been so important, and creating that culture, not only of curiosity, but actually that feeling that it's okay to take a risk, it's okay to try something new, and actually it's okay to learn from failure, like you said, but more importantly, what you do with it when you reflect and refine your practice. And even seeing that with the children, you can see that filtering down now, can't you, for how you set the culture in your classroom. So for me, every one of my roles over the years has evolved, but I think for me, research and inquiry has featured so importantly, because I can see that need for self-improvement. And ultimately, my role in school is to give our children the best provision they can, you know, to improve the outcomes for our learners. So again, like you, I haven't necessarily always got that academic hat on. And I think it was quite daunting for us as teachers at the beginning when, you know, the word research and inquiry sort of raised its head. It was, you'd thought, gosh, do I have to write an academic paper? Am I meant to be reading a book on somebody significant every week? You know, but actually, the more we've grown in that understanding, it is a mindset. And it is like, we're here to learn, we're here to be curious about what we can do to improve our practice. And on a personal level, I know Louise, who's going to be speaking next, we've been involved in projects. And as a school, we were slowly on that journey. And I think at a time when something called schools as learning organisations came into play, that almost gave us permission and almost made us feel, yes, we are on the right lines. You know, having a hunch, being curious about something. Now, we started doing things as a school that linked to our school improvement plan and just driving things that could take a long time as well. And it was okay to give ourselves permission to drill down deep and look at little things that we could tweak that could have the biggest impact on our learners. So for us, inquiry meant doing something in the classroom, reviewing what went right and what went wrong, and then tweaking to improve our practice, and then ultimately perhaps creating a policy. But it was the right way round. It wasn't just us presenting things to staff and saying, this is what we're going to do now, this is change. So, you know, when we talk about research and inquiry on a practical level from a school point of view, it's been really powerful for us to make progress, not always, you know, in a linear form, making mistakes and huge amounts of mistakes along the way, but seeing that you can have an impact on learners and having that agency to think, well, actually, we are in control of making a difference. So, yes, I've got my advocate's hat on. I can talk about the barriers later on and the things that have held us back, but I think generally it's really moved education in Wales forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. It's always nice to have you back on the podcast. Uh-huh. And Louise, this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because you actually were on the podcast as a questioner in one of our panel episodes this time last year, where you asked a brilliantly pokey question. The result of that is you've been upgraded to panelist and are going to discover what it's like from the other side of the table. But first of all, let's hear what you've got for us from the point of view of the regional consortia about inquiry.
No problem. Well, I think a lot of my role in regional consortia is about asking difficult questions, which is perhaps why I'm here, and trying to disrupt the system a little bit. I sit in a very, very fortunate position in that I get to work with wonderful practitioners like Sarah and Emma and countless others, but also with university partners. Matt probably gets bored with the amount of emails he receives from me. If I just give you my background as well, so I was a primary school teacher. And then I ended up seconded into a school improvement role in the consortium, and I just never went back. I suppose when I was a teacher, schools as learning organisations and the professional standards didn't reflect inquiry, they weren't around. So I would quite often sit in my classroom and think, why is that going on? What's that about? Let me try this. Does that work? No. OK, I'll try something else. And then when I ended up in this role and schools as learning organisations came about and the professional standards with their heavier focus on inquiry, I suddenly thought, oh, I wasn't just thinking through. I was actually doing a very sort of immature, I suppose, but a form of inquiry. Because I would sit there and I would think, oh, what's going on with this? And where I think you're all in a really fortunate position, and I wish that I had had when I was in the classroom, was that ability to engage with research, to properly understand some of my thoughts a little bit more. I wish I'd had that when I was in the classroom. I have to warn you, I have huge imposter syndrome about a lot of this, because I sit in things like this quite often. I might find myself talking to sort of government officials or with Matt and his colleagues, and I will think, I'm just a year six teacher. Let's put me back there, because that's where I belong and that's what I feel more comfortable knowing to do. And I'm probably going to echo a number of the things that Sarah and Emma have said. But what I thought would be helpful would just share some of the lessons that I've learned in my sort of privileged position of getting to work with a lot of schools. So the first one that we saw was when the professional standards came out in their current guise, and they featured inquiry, and then schools as learning organisations also with inquiry. I'd get lots of emails excitedly saying, oh, Lou, you've got to come to school. We're doing an inquiry. And I'd be like, that's great. I'll come in now. And I would look and my mind would be blown about how people find the capacity to engage in these really rich, deep inquiries that were making such a difference to learners. And I go, that's fantastic. What does that sit with on your school improvement plan? Or what is that supporting? And there was a blank. Oh, no, 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 it's just an inquiry. So I suppose my first thing is, don't do inquiry for inquiry's sake, because we see that does happen. And actually, you know, make it about your learners or what's going on in the school as a priority. Sarah mentioned culture. It's huge. I think you mentioned that someone spoke already this morning about inquiry is a mindset, and I can't advocate that enough. Inquiry is not a thing to be done. It should be a sort of way of being, I guess. Sarah alluded to this as well, but the value of no, it's not working. We are always, always very keen as teachers, and I include myself. I have to check myself on this sometimes to not go, yes, that was great, thank you. I'll do that again. That was wonderful. And actually, as Sarah said, we are there for the learners. And sometimes the most powerful thing you can do is say, that was awful. I'm never doing it again. I'm going to stop it. Also, the difference between innovation and invention. I have a lot of people think that in order to innovate, you have to be the first person to it or invent it. One of the things we're looking at the moment for teaching in the consortium is PCK, pedagogical content knowledge. Now, I think as a theory that was around the same age as me, so 40s, 40 odd years old, and yet we are innovating with it. So, and, you know, I wouldn't advocate always going back to the oldest research papers you can find, but it doesn't have to be brand new all of the time. There are some very solid sound theories that still go around because they're very solid sound theories. And I think that's probably about me.
Thank you very much, okay. Louise. I mean, that's music to my ears because my doctorate's on PCK. So we'll grab a cuppa later on.
That'd be nice.
Have a chat about Shulman. Okay, so handing over to Dr. Matt Hutt now. We also met at a podcast panel last year. So now you're on the panel yourself. What have you got to say to this theme?
Great. Well, thanks so much. And thanks for inviting me here this morning. My name's Matt Hutt, and I'm one of the heads of subject for education at University of South Wales. And if I can talk a little bit first about my own kind of history in education, my kind of personal journey over the last 30 years. So originally I was a secondary English teacher. And I do think once an English teacher, always an English teacher, it remained part of my kind of identity. And I'll bring that back in because it frames the way I think about inquiry. So for years I was a secondary English teacher, and then I had various leadership roles within secondary education before I moved into higher education about 7 or 8 years ago. And in my current job, my involvement with Close to Practice Inquiry focuses around a lot of the projects that have already been picked up by some of the speakers. So there's the National Professional Inquiry Project, the Embedding Research Evidence in Schools Project, Talk Pedagogy. And we work as with university colleagues, not just at USW, but across all the HEIs in Wales, to work with practitioners on Close to Practice Inquiry across all those projects. And frankly, it's one of the best bits of the job to be able to sit down with people and talk with them about an inquiry or a piece of research that's focused in on their professional practice, and work with them through from conceiving what it might look like, planning it out, and then deciding what to do with the findings and the results and how best to write it up. It is one of the best bits of my job. And the reason it's one of the best bits of my job, I think, is because I had a bit of a kind of road to Damascus conversion in my professional career. So I spent a lot of time as a school leader, kind of waist deep in doing the day-to-day bits of the job, and never really reflecting on why I was doing what I was doing. But then once I started doing that and inquiring into my own leadership practice, it was a massively, massively fascinating moment for me as a kind of professional, because I took that step back and I was thinking about the things I did as a school leader rather than just like doing the stuff all the time and not reflecting on it. It sounds obvious now you say it, isn't it? But actually, I spent years and years and years just like doing stuff and getting things off my to-do list and moving on to the next thing. And so my understanding of close to practice inquiry is all about that kind of an extension of reflective practice. It's that idea, isn't it, that the unexamined life perhaps isn't really worth living, but the examined life is really, really important. And the other thing that I find, the thing about practice, close to practice inquiry that I find really, really interesting, and I think this comes from kind of self-identifying as an English teacher, is the thing I find really interesting is the way that those inquiries are communicated, the way they're discussed, the way they're read, the kind of claims to knowledge they make. It's that kind of textual element to it that I find particularly interesting. And that kind of sustains my interest in close to practice inquiry, not just the substantial kind of pedagogic leadership elements, but also the way it's expressed as well.
Thank you very much to all of our panellists. I think we've shone light on this theme in lots of different ways over the course of those presentations. There's lots to dig into, but you've probably noticed that Tom's got a microphone on a very long wire poised and ready for your questions. Perhaps whilst I'm giving you time to think about those, and I will come to the audience, I just wanted to pick up on this idea of perhaps a bit of tension between school improvement and inquiry that I think many of you have mentioned can be can take you a few steps backwards sometimes. It can involve taking risk. And when we're talking about school improvement, we kind of want to be going in a generally positive upward trajectory, don't we? So how do you, and maybe this is one to start off with for school colleagues, how do you support staff to take those creative risks, but when they're also feeding into that broader agenda that largely we'd like to be quite positive and progressive?
Do you want me to answer?
Yeah.
Yes. I think you're right. It is about giving people permission to take a risk. And it is treading on very fine territory, isn't it? When you are conscious, you want to have, you know, that evidence, as you said, Louise, that everything's going brilliantly and everything's going great. We're on that trajectory of, you know, making an impact, a positive impact. But I think for me, I learnt very quickly, it's about honesty. And I think there's much more mileage in having those difficult and honest conversations with, whether it's an improvement partner or, you know, talking to other professionals or your colleagues in school, because we learn the most from not hiding away from failure. And I think certainly on a personal level, going back a few years now, we were on a journey of improvement for our feedback and formative assessment. Now on paper, we were making fantastic strides. You know, we were looking at what live feedback meant. We were looking at, you know, in those days, it was all about, you know, what your developmental next steps were. Now we made great improvements, but actually the nitty gritty of it was that staff were really tired and well-being dropped. So the irony being, when we were looking at improving something, something else dipped. So we had to have difficult conversations and have that raw honesty that said, well, while we've improved something, something else has gone backwards. But I think we had to say, well, this is our aspiration, this is where we want to be, but as a staff, we have the solutions together. And I think that was a shift in culture for me, because it was almost like we have to come up for the solutions that will have authentic longevity rather than compliance and lip service to school, you know, school improvement. So I think you're right, it's having bravery to say we're going to run with it, keep with it, but we have to be flexible along the way. But it's very hard when you have so many pressures on you as a school. But I think schools as learning organisations has given us that permission. You know, it talks about the rhythm of improvement, doesn't it? And the rhythm of learning in a school. I think as long as you can stay true to your vision and say, we want what's best for the children, but we're going to make authentic change. And we can only do that by having honest conversations. So hopefully we're on a journey on the right way.
Yes, I was going to say actually very similarly I always talk about research and inquiry needing to be put in your school context. And in a secondary school setting, that can look very different from subject to subject. So one of the things that for me has always underpinned the fact that, yes, that might not, you know, a close to practice inquiry that works brilliantly in a PE lesson doesn't necessarily work brilliantly in a maths lesson. And that is equally as valid. But it's that reflection on, well, why is that working better there and not so well there? So the breadth of that inquiry can sometimes give you that as a handle. handle into, well, is it just something that is relevant in that context or is it a bit wider? So it does help to drive that. And for us in Whitchurch, we've built it into the school improvement plan, but in quite a broad way, so that it's the encouragement of a research and inquiry approach within our faculties that we're trying to achieve, rather than necessarily pinning everything on a particular inquiry, so that it gives people that scope, I think, to really find their own professional itch and what is it that you need to do as a faculty to move your progression on.
Thank you. Louise, I can see you're ready.
I am. I am. You can't say school improvement and not expect me to pipe up. So I suppose it's worth noting, and you know, you'll always have this one in your back pocket to bring out to people, that school improvement in its earliest iteration was an inquiry process. Accountability drove the system in a different way, but when it first came into being back in those glorious days when it was really well funded and there was all sorts of things going on, it was designed to be an inquiry process. I think when you're in a school and, you know, you don't know what you don't know. As I said, one of the privileges of my job is that I get to sort of almost have a bit of a helicopter view across a number of schools. And at the first year I was out of my own setting, I realised how much I didn't know because I'd just been in my one place. And that's been one of the joys of NPEP and all working together, hasn't it? That we've had that sort of cross-pollination of ideas. I think as well, and you'll know this more keenly than most on a PGCE course, I imagine, but time is precious and research gives us best bets. And actually, we haven't got time to waste with something that's really been proven to be ineffective. So whilst, you know, we want to avoid isomorphism and we don't want people just picking something up and going, I'm going to do exactly that in exactly that way, because that's dangerous in and of itself, that notion of best bets is really helpful. Nothing we do should ever be driven by Estyn. However, Estyn, when they come in, want to know that the school knows itself and they can justify how it knows itself and they have a plan. They don't want to know that it's perfect. And that shouldn't drive our behaviour, but I think it sort of perfectly echoes the point that Sarah made around that. And I guess the other thing, and this is sort of that Emma was alluding to then, and I see it quite a lot, it allows you, and particularly, you know, for Sarah and Emma in school leadership roles, but to have that line between consistency and uniformity. You can be consistent and have very different approaches in your PE classroom and your maths classroom. You could be consistent and have parallel year four classes with very different approaches, because the learners in that classroom are different, but the consistency is the principles that underpin it. So again, I think inquiry gives you that robust understanding of your why. Because often, as Matt said, I had a little wry smile, Matt, when he said you were just doing stuff. I was just doing stuff for ages as well. It was great. And someone would come and watch my lesson with a tick list, and they tick every time I'd done it. And then I did a wicked lesson. It was great. It was so much easier than what you have to do now. But actually, it's what you do now in terms of that reflective space is so much more powerful. So, yeah, sorry, I couldn't not pipe up then.
Thank you very much. Did you want to come in, Matt, or are you happy?
Just one thing. I think the thing is, it's about that idea of school improvement. If it's just seen as quite a kind of reductive, linear, straightforward process, then of course inquiry fits into that in a quite a difficult, problematic way. But as we all know, on the ground, school improvement is much more a kind of uneven, uncertain, general method of travel, but not in a kind of a specific straight line. And that's the reality of school improvement, and the reality of inquiry also retains that idea of uncertainty. If we knew what we were going to get out at the end of it, we wouldn't bother doing the inquiry in the first place, because there'd be nothing to inquire into. There'd be nothing to flesh out. There'd be nothing to explore. So just engaging in the idea of inquiry means, you know, bringing into the central of our kind of professional practice the idea of uncertainty and the idea that things may or may not turn out in a particular way. So if we think about school improvement in a more kind of broad kind of realistic way, that it's going to have variety of kind of perhaps cul-de-sacs and, you know, slight false turns and stuff, but generally the movement will be one in a kind of positive direction. I think inquiry fits into it quite well. It's just that kind of cartoon idea of school improvement. It's just, we'll simply do this, then we'll do this, then we'll do this, then we'll do that, and then we'll be at the position that we need to be at. That's more problematic, I think.
Thank you all. Okay, so we're quite keen to hear from our soon-to-be newly qualified teachers in the audience. So does anybody have a question for the panel that they'd feel comfortable asking out loud?
Bearing in mind that my mic and I are between you and the exit. Oh, here we go. I'm on the move.
If you'd like to just tell us who you are and what programme you're on.
Hi, my name's Helen. I'm on PGC Primary. My question's for Sarah. You talked about sometimes small tweaks making the biggest impact in the classroom. I just wondered if you could give us an example of that.
I didn't pay you to ask that question, did I? Because I might have one up my sleeve. I think you're right, because, I mean, realistically, you know, when we talk about inquiry, if we had pots of money, it would be fantastic. But I think for us, keeping our eye on improving teaching and learning, we know has the biggest impact on our learners. So most recently, I suppose, we were very curious about our vulnerable learners. And as you always are, thinking, how can we close the gap? You know, between our children who are eligible for free school meals and, you know, gender gaps and all those sort of areas which I know lots of schools are concerned with. And I think one of the things we talked about was, you know, what could we do very simply to tweak our practice to have the biggest impact? And nothing was revolutionary. Nothing was, you know, innovative in the sense it was anything new. But all we did a couple of years ago was shine a light on our children who, through conversation and dialogue with our teachers, and really importantly, giving it time and space through professional learning in our insets and twilight, was basically get teachers together to look at data. Now, it's not all about the data, but having conversations around engagement as well. And we chose 6 children that we were really concerned about, for whatever reason, weren't engaged in the learning process, whether it was attendance or, you know, whatever issues they were facing. And all we said was, right, these are our 6 children that we're going to focus on, but what can we do to tweak our practice to make sure that they're not being lost in the system? So we just basically said things like, simple things like, where do they sit in the class, you know? Are they at the back or at the front? Do they engage in, you know, sort of shared discussion on the carpet, or, you know, when they're with friends, who are we going to sit them with when we're giving feedback? Are these the children we're just going to notice first of all and go towards? Pre-learning, you know, if you've got a lesson coming, maybe giving them access to the text or whatever they're doing before it starts. We started to look at what our mornings looked like at certain points in the day. Were there opportunities in our day that we could tweak what we were doing? We recognised there was a bit of dead time when they come into the classroom. So we looked at opportunities for pre-learning then, and, you know, mopping up the misconceptions, perhaps in group rotation. So it sounds really simple, but just by shining a light, the impact it's had on our learners has been quite outstanding. It's not all a success story, you'll be pleased to know, Lou. You know, we've got data and, you know, anecdotal evidence that shows we don't always hit the right children and we don't make that wonderful curve of, you know, progress. And where we haven't, we explore deeper. You know, are there additional needs we haven't quite discovered, or is there a conversation around other factors? But what it has done is shown us that by just shining a light on the children that might just be lost through the system in your class has made a really powerful impact, generally, not always, but it's something now we've sort of said, well, it's good practice, let's just keep this going. So it's something that's as simple as, well, let's just track these children and have those dialogues termly, and it's made a real difference. Talking about research and theory, you know, I'm not doing a plug for CSE, but we had a document called Enabling Equity and Excellence. And when I read it, it was like a eureka moment. And it was so simple, accessible for me as a head, but it really was, how well do you know your learners? And I thought, that's it. Well, what are the barriers to learning? And for us in Palmerston, it's access, you know, attitude, achievement. And for us, it matters so much that we remove barriers, whether it is the fact that they're not engaged in coming to school. So what can we do to improve attendance, which again is a huge issue for us in schools at the moment. So just one little thing, you know, and just shining a light, didn't cost any money. But again, on our journey, it's made, you know, a bit of a difference. So I'm glad you asked that. But as I said, it's not one big tick of success, but what it has done is shown us that that can make a difference. So thank you.
Can I just mention as well, so I think it's a really good question, and Sarah massively plays down the instrumental role she has. I have nagged her for years to do stuff for me, and she's always done it, which is nice. But the notion of baby and bathwater there is hugely important. So with the curriculum for Wales, as is now, one of my other hats in the consortium is learning and teaching, and I would have a lot of people inviting me to school or emailing me or calling me with a degree of desperation saying, Lou, how do we teach in the new curriculum? What's good teaching in the new curriculum? Whoa, what's good teaching now? How do we teach to read in the new curriculum? How do you do that now? Does it have an impact? So that idea of baby and bathwater and change for the sake of change, just that's, I suppose, an unintended consequence sometimes of some of the policy decisions that you can safeguard against. Because if you know your learners, I will do a shameless plug for CSE, you can get the document from the website, help yourselves, Enabling Equity and Excellence document. But it's got 3 questions that it consistently asks through the document. Who are our learners? What do they bring? And therefore, what do they need? And it's about, so we see our learners not through a deficit model, we see what they bring. But yeah.
Thank you very much. Great question, Helen. Thank you for that. Okay, any other questions from our audience?
Oh, a short journey for me.
Hi, my name is Oscar. I'm actually a classroom teacher for 6 years. So if I could just flip it slightly. We know that student teachers have a breadth of knowledge regarding the research or inquiry, and we know they have so many strengths. How can we use them in our research inquiry? How can we use their strengths to better us?
Can I answer that one? So effectively, I think that, Oscar, is exactly what I was trying to achieve the past 2 years. What I have done to enable that closer connection between what my student teachers are doing in school and what my the wider staff body is doing is that when we create, or when I as the research champion create the themes that my student teachers choose from to do their first assignment, those are themes that are underpinning very much the school improvement plan. There are things like disadvantaged learners, closing the gap, etc., all the way through to assessment for learning. And I try to make sure that they're broad enough. And then what that enables me to do is to literally be able to say to my student teachers, the research that you do is going to be shared with my teaching staff. So it empowers them to know that actually what they pull together will be shared. And then in those annotated bibliography, the visually enhanced summaries that they deliver, they deliver those to SLT, who give me direct feedback. And then anything that is being done within a research inquiry sort of vein in the wider staff body, I can say, right, I've got information that you can use. Because, of course, as I think somebody already said, time is exceedingly precious. And the biggest barrier that I always feel to teachers, established teachers, really engaging with research and inquiry is this dread, I haven't got time to do it. So at any point, if I can literally say to them, you don't need time because there is, you can use that. And that has really helped me this year. And I think it's something that we can move forward with as a useful model.
Thank you very much. Great question. And I guess sort of zooming out from that as well, we've got this, not an issue, but we've got an important issue of transition from student teacher to NQT year. And the expectation to continue to inquire, I think, has been, you know, very well put forward, and the reason why we should be doing that. But it can be hard. And I can imagine some people in the audience might be thinking, well, I've had ring fence time on my PGC programme for research inquiry. It doesn't always work out that way. But on paper, you've had that time gifted to you to do research inquiry. That is significantly diminished in the NQT year. You might find yourself as an NQT in a department or in a school that is a little bit further back on their inquiry journey. Where can you go to, you know, and maybe to schools out there wanting to support their NQTs and keeping that momentum going, you know, how is it possible to do that?
I think, interestingly, I was talking about this earlier on in my presentation to the PGC students. I think it's really important for PGC students, as they turn to NQTs, to recognise the power that they have, the expertise that they have, that it far outweighs a lot of established teachers, the background in research, etc. And then to keep it small and realistic, that you don't have to try and change the world. But research and inquiry, I have this endless conversation with the PGC students when, you know, I pop into the staff room and they're sitting there and I say, are you doing your research and inquiry? Yes, we're doing our research inquiry. And my question is, well, get out there and see it, because that is your research and inquiry. So exactly the same way as I would encourage them in their PGC year to go and observe and to dip into classrooms and to have conversations, that's equally valid and valuable, to actually talk to teachers. So it may well be that you just have one class that you just can't crack, that drive you mad every week. And they're the ones that, if you can talk to somebody else that maybe teaches that class and then work on strategies, that's close to practice inquiry. So it doesn't have to look like a whole project or a whole theme that you have to drive forward, but you can show know the impact of that. You can reflect on it. And even if I would always suggest to NQTs that they have perhaps one other person, that's all it takes, is just somebody else to be a different pair of eyes, to look at what you've done, to take on board, well, what went well with it, what didn't, and then you're looking at impact together.
Thank you, Emma. Louise looks poised and ready to come
in
here.
I am, sorry, I feel like I'm talking too much.
Not at all.
I suppose one of my reflections is, genuinely in a classroom today, I don't know how you don't use inquiry. Because there are, we did once do a count, but I can't remember the number of how many questions there are in the system. In, you know, if you scan on Hub and look through any of the documentation there, if you look at the National Resource for Evaluation and Improvement, we've thrown in the Equity and Excellence document. There's a frightening number of questions in the system. Some days I feel overwhelmed by questions. With all those questions, you can't really answer them without inquiry. I think what Emma was saying then is so powerful, because one of the things that I do get my soapbox out quite a lot is that we don't need a two-tier system. As I said, working with Matt and his colleagues is fantastic. And the MPEP's a very specific project, and they follow a process and go through certain way. And Matt and I also work together on another national project looking at how you get different models of inquiry across the school. But I'm a firm believer that if you do a learning walk or a book scrutiny, you've just done an inquiry, because you've looked at something and thought, what does it tell me and how do I make it better? And I suppose in its core, for me, that's what it is. And if I ever am in charge of the world, which is unlikely, but I will stop everything being about accountability and make it developmental. Because for me, that, and that inquiry, hold on to that as the linchpin for doing it. Because if you're looking at book scrutiny, you know, or you're having your books looked at, it's quite vulnerable. That's the thing about inquiry, and I'm sure this has been touched on to you many times before. You have to be quite vulnerable and say, this is my practice, come and look at it. These are my books, look at them. And the difference between critique and criticism within that space, if I ask a colleague, I do it now, I mean, obviously I'm not in the classroom, but I'll ask people to look at my documents and say, please give me feedback. But the first few times I did that, it was quite uncomfortable, but I think it's a really healthy space to be in. So absolutely, there's a place for every part of the inquiry continuum, but I don't think you could be in a classroom and not at the moment.
Thank you very much. Do we have any further questions from the audience? Tom?
One from me?
I saw your hand up there, Tom. You can ask the question.
Yeah,
please.
I was just thinking now, we're recording this right at the very, very tail end of what is a very long year of PGCE for the people that are sitting in here. They're about to become NQTs. One of the things that might feel like it happens is perhaps the university context is going to sort of fade into the background a little bit. We've heard loads about, you know, getting into it in your classroom, the sort of school improvements, sort it out in your context. I suppose question for Matt really, is there still a role for the university once people have escaped, once I've moved away from the exit and they've escaped out into the world? How can we as university actually support this process?
Yeah, no, I think that is that's a really interesting question. And of course, the way that's been supported over the last few years, it's been funded by Welsh Government. So, you know, we've been funded to take part in projects, to devote time and resources to working with teachers. But that funding may not be around forever. And, you know, we've had to think about what might it look like in a few years' time to have a kind of a vibrant and ongoing, sustainable inquiry community that stretches across HE colleagues and school practitioners and people working in FE, and is kind of a self-supporting collective. And so the way that you develop that without resourcing is actually quite difficult, because you're asking people to, and it always comes back to time, doesn't it? You know, there's no, I'd never meet anyone who says, well, I've got loads of time for that. People are always kind of trying to do things on the hoof, aren't they? But it seems to me that there are things to do with the democratization of kind of academic resources and knowledge that's making that more straightforward. So, you know, even, I mean, I'm talking about AI and stuff, even in the last year, the kind of things that you can use for free, or if you pay for it, you get a slightly better version, to help you look at the existing research around a particular thing, it's massively changed. So if you go on something like SciSpace and type in an inquiry question, even on the free version, it'll bring up the summaries of 10 papers and talk about the different methods they used. And, you know, that's a massively revolutionised the way in which people can interact with the HE community, not necessarily HE people that you know, and the local university, but people working in HE elsewhere. And that's changed dramatically over the last year or so. And it's produced, you know, a piece of work that you could generate in a couple of, 30 seconds, really, typing something in that it might have taken someone, you know, a day to do, perhaps even longer. So I think in terms of developing those kind of sustainable things, we might not get the resourcing to do it, but I think that actually the technology will plug some of those gaps. So I think there are some kind of exciting possibilities there.
Thank you very much. I have one final question that might sort of bring us to a close. It's not one with an easy answer, but I'm curious to know how inquiry is perhaps changing or disrupting the relationship between senior leadership, working with teachers to develop their practice and to guarantee sort of teacher improvement. And I wonder if it's changing conversations or approaches to things like classroom observation. How is that relationship affected now by this idea of sort of curiosity, innovation, risk-taking, you know, and helping us to move away from the sort of observation with a clipboard and a checkbox? I think we're far from that now, but I'd love to know how it's sort of changing that relationship.
Do you want me to come in for that a little bit? Yeah. So I think there is a much greater understanding in the system that we have all the questions, we don't have all the answers, and the answers can come from unexpected places. I think whilst we are a way away from the tick box culture, we've still got a way to travel. So, I mean, when, as Sarah mentioned, the first time research and inquiry was mentioned, it was quite frightening. If I'm honest, I was a little bit anxious to think, gosh, where's all this going to go? You know, I haven't done all these further qualifications. It's a long time since I've been in university. What am I going to do with this? So we have come an awfully long way since that, but there is still distance to travel. I think in the most successful schools, it is that rhythm of learning that Sarah mentioned, that there's a real openness to understand the why, to create those causal narratives between, oh, we tried this and this happened, so we tried this, and they can sort of talk you through their story. The elephant in the room is accountability that sits outside of schools. So sometimes that's levelled at us as a consortia, other times at Estyn and various other bodies who might be interested in what's going on in a school. Hopefully, I am ever the optimist, the policy landscape in Wales, I actually feel very, very privileged to work in the Welsh education context. Don't ask me that some days, I'll give you a different answer. But on the whole, I feel very privileged to work in the Welsh context, because actually, if you look at the policy, and I'm sure you've sort of been immersed in the various different aspects of the curriculum that exist. We have the perfect setup to have the best education system in the world. And I mean that very sincerely. I have a child in the system, so I'm very invested in it. We have all our ducks in a row. We just need it all to fall into place. And we're on the cusp of it. But I'm part of a collaboration where we work with colleagues in Northern Ireland and Scotland and in north of England as well. And when I look at some of their policy landscapes, there is real challenge everywhere. So I guess that's my kind of battle cry to you, please. Keep fighting the good fight and don't give up on it. But honestly, it is a privilege to work in Wales, and I say that sincerely.
Thank you. Any other thoughts on that one,
yes,
Sarah?
I think you're right, Emma. I think for me, again, it's, you know, it's always money, isn't it, to have that time and space for people to connect with each other. But if you can make it work, just having those open conversations and colleagues naturally chatting about improvement and inquiry together, looking at each other's settings, talking about what they're doing, sharing the work, sharing those activities, and having that, you know, getting away from that closed door sort of culture where everybody does their own little thing in their classes. And again, that's a shift in mindset, because that can be daunting, exposing yourself, as you said, you know, and all you do, and feeling vulnerable about that. But I think if we can move away from that, I think the key purpose of this is to improve, again, ourselves as professionals and what we can offer our pupils, then, you know, getting that culture away from, you know, that high threat. You know, we always talk about sort of high challenge, low threat, and that's where the ideal sweet spot is for me. So long may it last, and, you know, let's keep going with that mindset.
Yes, I was going to agree there, Sarah. I think it's about shifting the way that we talk about the outcomes of what we've been looking into a professional dialogue, so that it is actually more of a, it sits more comfortably with that review process, so that it's not like a traditional performance management assessment and lesson observation. It is about, can you come and see? We often refer to it as dip-ins, in terms of like, can you come and see and put your eyes on what I've done? And that is really important, that those professional dialogues that we have as colleagues and are framed by, well, what did you see, rather than what were you hoping? And you can then really kind of think about the impact that little tweak like that could actually have.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've had a vibrant discussion. We've been through all of the avenues of classroom practice and close to classroom practice inquiry. And now it's time to sort of leave our audience really with those thoughts and to give you a big open hand invitation to take this out into your future careers, to keep that professional curiosity, but to remember that you're not alone in those endeavours, and doing that together as a community of teachers of the future is what we would invite you to go on doing. Thank you very much to our panel of experts.
Yes, thank you to Emma, Sarah, Louise and Matt. Thank you to our audience, and we will be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. This episode was recorded in front of a live audience at our PGC Research Conference in June. On the panel, Emma Aston from Whitchurch High School, Sarah Kaysen from Palmerston Primary School, Louise Mutum from Central South Consortium, and Dr. Matthew Hutt from the University of South Wales. Thanks to them for taking part, and thanks also to our audience. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford, and the music is by Cameron Stewart. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.